KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Charles Foster's latest book expresses ideas he's been working out really all his life. Can you come to know what it's like to be an animal? Can you make a real connection with something wild? So Foster tried to live like a badger and an otter and a fox, a deer, a swift. He dug a hole in a hillside. He swam in the dark holes of a river. He tried to get a sense of what it was like to be hunted. And even though he knew it was impossible to get inside the mind of a creature, he says the effort is worth it. And there were moments when he feels like he made some kind of connection. Foster has said if he can know something about an animal, maybe he could know something about his wife or his kids or his friends. He'll join us today to talk about what he learned from being a beast. After the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. For maybe as long as he can remember, Charles Foster's been trying to get close to animals. In his new book, he explains part of this was the conviction that they knew something he didn't. One of his first attempts trying to understand a creature was a blackbird in his garden as a kid. He writes about sitting for hours reading, mapping nests in the area, collecting egg fragments and blackbird parts. But it didn't work, he says. The blackbird remained as elusive as ever. And in some ways, it's not really a spoiler to say the same thing happened with the animals he writes about in this book. As a grown-up, as a writer, adventurer, veterinarian, Oxford tutor, attorney, Foster tried to live like a badger, like an otter, a fox, a deer, and a swift. And he went all in, or as close as he could at times. He slept in a burrow, was chased by bloodhounds, tried catching fish with his teeth in a river. He did some even stranger things, too, which we may get to. And Foster admits those creatures are still mysterious and elusive. But he says there's a profound lesson in trying to be a beast. That's the name of the book, Being a Beast, Adventures Across the Species Divide. And Charles Foster is joining us today to talk about it. He's a fellow of Green Templeton College at the University of Oxford, a qualified veterinarian, and as I said, teaches medical law and ethics, a practicing barrister. Joining us from the studios of the BBC in Oxford, and Charles Foster, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's great to be with you. Thank you very much.
I've heard you say that this particular book is something that you've actually been working on all your life. Is it true, something you've been, these ideas that you've been thinking about all a long time?
It is true, and I hope that everything that each of us says seriously is the product of the whole of a lifetime reflection. And certainly when you commit something to paper and ask other people to take it seriously, you owe it to them to bring to it everything that you have been. So I don't think I'm unusual in saying that, yeah, this is the product of everything which I have been digesting intellectually ever since I was, ever since I first burst into the world as a human being.
There's an epigram in the book from the writer Jonathan Safran Foer that seems to reflect a theme. There are a number of themes here, but this idea that when you explore the lives of animals, it's not necessarily just about the creature, but it also is what it means to be human. Is that a theme, you think, in the book?
Very, very much so. There's a bad mistake in the very first line of this book. The first line reads, I want to know what it is to be a wild thing. And of course, I don't know anything other than what it is like to be a wild thing. I'm necessarily a wild thing. David Abraham, the American philosopher and naturalist, says rightly that there are only ever relatively unwild places. If you leave out a piece of bread in the most pristine urban environment you can think of, a condo in Manhattan, for example, you come back a week later and it's covered with a magnificent wild efflorescence of bacteria and fungi. The gut of the CEO of Monsanto is a wild seething mass of bacteria which he needs in order to survive. So I am necessarily a wild thing. I have evolutionary relationships with all of the creatures that I looked at in this book, which are very close. I've only got to flick back a few pages in my family album to find furred and feathery and scaly faces. And so I think the right way to read the title of this book is not Charles Foster undertook a project to find out what it was like to be a beast. It should be read in a different tone of voice, something like, being a beast, Charles Foster walked along to the corner shop to buy a chocolate bar.
Right. Did you know at the outset, was this something you think you understood from the outset, that you would essentially fail to get in the head of an animal, that was kind of an impossible task, although worth going after?
I thought it was worth going after. I didn't think I would get very far.
Right.
And indeed, I didn't get very far.
Yeah.
And the reason I was pessimistic about getting very far was because I don't think any of us get very far in understanding the contents of the heads, even of those people who we love and think we know best. So the contents of the heads of fellow human beings represent almost completely inaccessible worlds. The exploration of the contents of other people's heads is far more difficult and far more exciting than the exploration of the most distant galaxies. Mm. So if we can't know what's going on in the head of the shop assistant, with whom I share even more DNA than I share with a badger, what real hope have I got of trying to enter a badger's world? But it's worth trying for a number of reasons. It's worth trying because I love the places where badgers live, and badgers can tell me something about how better to perceive those worlds. And another reason is that if I hone in trying to enter the heads of non-human species the tools of empathy, then I'm probably going to be a better father and friend and husband. So trying to be a badger makes you a better husband.
You say you had a kind of naive hope that writing the book would have very little of yourself in it, that you wouldn't necessarily, it wouldn't be a, kind of the memoir that it seems like now, but it turned out to be kind of your own rewilding. Was that a surprise, that it was so personal?
It was a surprise to me when I saw that people were describing it as a memoir. And it shocked me because I wasn't saying in that sentence you just quoted that I hope there'll be none of myself in me. I wasn't saying that out of, you know, touching British self-effacement. I genuinely hope that I'd be able to excise myself from it, because if I could excise myself from it, Charles Foster wouldn't obscure the wonderful sights and smells and sounds of the woodland and the moorland and the river. And I think that it turned into a memoir, which I now see that it is, really because I learnt that human children perceive the natural world in so much clearer a way than we do. And my own children were my great guides and teachers when I was attempting this project. They've lost so much less of the affinity which we all can have with the natural world than we have. And so it became a memoir because, of course, I was a child once.
Yeah.
And in going back into my own past, I was able to unforget some of the things which normally prevent us from seeing the natural world properly.
You know, I made a reference to that story you tell about trying to kind of divine the life of the blackbird in your garden, which, as you say, didn't work. But you say that the mysteriousness of that creature was kind of one of the great lessons of your childhood. And in fact, you say if you had, in fact, in some way, figured the blackbird out, it could have been a kind of catastrophe for you.
Yes. One of the most dangerous heresies which any of us can have is that we understand anything. If we think we can understand anything, we begin to think that we can understand people. And that's a terrible thing. It drains people of their inaccessibility, of their mystery, of their color. It's presumption. and it leads to the most terrible abuses of power. So, yes, I was very lucky to have been struck as a child as forcibly as I was with the notion that there were always going to be things that I couldn't fathom. The fact that the things that I couldn't fathom were things that I desperately wanted to fathom, so the life of this beautiful bird, was a great bequest to me.
Your father let you wander, let you experiment, let you take creatures apart. And in fact, as we learn in the book, you enlist your own family, your children, in these projects. Is that something that you learned from your father, the idea of sort of making this kind of a family affair?
I don't think it was something I learned from my father. It was a conviction which I acquired later in life, after I had lost so much myself by becoming big and adult and putting on a suit. I acquired the conviction that children have better eyes and better noses, which is both physiologically true and true in lots of other ways. So I do have a fairly romantic, almost prelapsarian view of what children can see. I recruited them very cynically because they were the best guides.
Yeah. And Tom is great at finding toads.
Yes. I mean, Tom, who was 8 when I was writing this book, is known in our area as Little Tommy Toadcatcher. Mm-hmm. And he used to have this almost clairvoyant ability to go into a field and sort of move his head around. And then he would stride straight across the field and pick up a stone, and there a toad would be. And there wouldn't be a toad on either side of that stone. And it wasn't that he just knew where toads were likely to be and was looking in the right places. You know, there was some sort of weird, freaky connection between him and toads, which in the English Middle Ages would have no doubt got him burnt as a warlock.
But this idea is kind of a theme, I have to say, in the book. You write something that intrigued me. And we'll come back to the bigger idea before, this idea of sort of shamanic transformations, because you say that you don't for a moment want to deny the reality of a true shamanic transformation. And it doesn't seem like you want to spend a whole lot of time talking about this, so maybe we won't. But you experienced some kind of thing, some kind of transformation with a crow. You don't spend a lot of time with it because I think you're worried about how you'll be perceived or whatever. But this idea of intuition and this, I'm not sure clairvoyance is the right way of thinking about it. But I don't know, that just seems to be something that you touch on in the book at times.
Well, I don't spend a lot of time talking about that strange crow experience because I don't know what it meant.
Yeah.
I think it would be really arrogant for me to categorize that as a true shamanic experience.
Sure.
In every culture other than our own, people have talked about the porosity of the boundary separating humans and animals, and they have suggested that it's possible to shuttle to and fro across that boundary. The very first indications that we have that humans are cognitively normal is in those great Upper Paleolithic cave paintings of Europe and Africa, in which we see animal-human hybrids, which are interpreted by the archaeologists and anthropologists as an indication that humans were transforming into animals and going back again. And those are associated with the kindling of whatever it is which makes us quintessentially human. And I am far too frightened to go down the shamanic route myself. I simply don't have the nerve, even if I have the cognitive apparatus to do it. I think these accounts are too ubiquitous in all of the anthropological literature simply to dismiss, but it will be presumptuous in the extreme for me to say that I've had anything which stands alongside those. So I look with respect at people who've had those experiences. I include some of those people as close friends, but it's not my route. My route is the much more prosaic one, which recognises, sure, that there's a sort of porosity of the species boundary, but only in the sense that Darwin talked about 150 years ago.
Of course, right. It does also get to something that you've written and talked about, that the scientific academy has its share of sort of fundamentalism, inability. And in fact, you say that you would have written a better book had you not been, as you put it, marinated in science.
Right. So, yes, there is a really dominant, toxic fundamentalism in science. If you're a professional scientist, you are required to sign up to a certain set of beliefs, a belief in a particular way of looking at Darwinian natural selection, for example, an assumption that there are no other ways of generating complexity. Although, I mean, to be fair, that particular dogma has been liberalised in recent years. But yeah, when it comes to explaining some of the phenomena which lots of us have had, scientists generally say, oh, that cannot happen. It doesn't fit within any of the paradigms which rule our world, and therefore it cannot happen. Exactly the same sort of intransigence and intellectual inflexibility which caused the medieval church to flagellate Galileo. So for example, many of us have had experiences of precognition. It doesn't happen, say the scientific fundamentalists. Lots of dogs know when their owners are coming home, even when the owners change their plans at the last minute. It can't happen, say the fundamentalists. And we can perhaps talk later about some other examples which connected into my own experience of Swift's.
Yeah, it was a beautiful one. We'll come back to that.
But in relation to whether I would be a better enter into the minds of badgers had I not had the scientific background that I've got, I think that's probably right. I was marinated in scientific orthodoxy. I had to begin my research for each of these chapters by reading all the physiological papers about badger and fox and so on, sense receptors and how that information was centrally processed, and then I had to go out into the wood and try to forget a lot of that rather than being formed by it. So I think this is a much more religious book than it is a scientific book, by which I mean this. The former chief rabbi of Great Britain, Jonathan Sacks, says that science takes things apart to see how it works. Religion puts things together to try and find out what they mean. And in that sense, this is a religious book, because it's more about trying to find out what things mean than about how they work. And there is, of course, a sense in which those two domains should be informing one another. And I hope that there is some sort of conversation between those two domains in this book. But it's a lot more religious in that sense than it is scientific.
Yeah. One of the problems, and you sort of, that first chapter of the book is where you sort of cop to the problems with your approach. One of them, as you say, is really getting into the mind of an animal, in the sense that you're a human, you know, that the universe you occupy is a creature of your head. This is wholly unique to you. But you also see that humans tend to kind of denigrate our own sensory lives, that we assume wild things are some way different or they do things better, and it's not. It's something you say that we need. That's not really so.
Yeah, I mean, our senses aren't as bad as we tend to think that they are. I think we tend to think that they are because we overvalue sight and we overvalue cognition, which is very tightly tied to sight. But yeah, our senses aren't so bad. For example, there was a guy called Jack Schwartz, who insisted that he could see auras around people. Nonsense, of course, said the scientists. And then a physiologist called Adams tested him, and he found out that Jack Schwartz could indeed see supposedly invisible infrared radiation. Well, that was interesting enough. But then Adams tested himself, and he found out that he could detect supposedly invisible infrared radiation. And I think there are many examples like that. When people become blind, they can learn to echolocate, like bats, from the taps on their on their sticks. Our olfactory sense, which we tend to denigrate, is not so bad. So if you present three worn T-shirts to people, three quarters of people can detect their own worn T-shirt amongst those three, and three quarters of people can detect their own worn T-shirts amongst 10 which are presented to them. And so that's just talking about our ordinary natural senses. Aquinas talked about us having 10 senses, and I think he's probably right. But even if we've only got the 5 that we conventionally suppose we have, it seems to me to be a very great shame that we usually use only one, our vision.
Right.
So we're only seeing 1/5 of what we might see of this glorious world. We're only getting 1/5 of the colour and the complexity and the beauty and the mystery. Mm. Oh, what a shame that is.
Yeah.
And I think that vision, which is the sense that we tend to lead with, does distort in a way that olfaction and hearing don't. But because it's so intimately connected with our cognition, you know, our visual images immediately become our thoughts about those visual images. So when I go into a wood, I don't see a tree.
Yeah.
I see Charles Foster's thoughts about a tree,
yeah.
Which are hugely less interesting than the tree, hugely less beautiful than the tree, and are a much less accurate reflection of the tree than we would get if we use more than one sense. So I think we have, as a result of our failure to use our senses, if you want to put it pompously, an epistemological crisis. We don't know as many facts about the world as we should. And because we don't know the facts about the world that we should, we are baffled by it. We are intimidated by it. Mm. We feel estranged from it in a way which is sad and unnecessary, and makes us rebel against it in all sorts of really pathological ways, which are bad for us and very bad for the world, as we're increasingly seeing.
When we get back from a break, we'll talk about the particulars of the animal experiences that you write about. But I wanted to ask you first, you used to be a hunter. And in fact, you've said you're not really all that proud of that part of your life. You said it calloused you, but you did learn lessons.
Hmm.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, I mean, to say that I'm not proud of it is an understatement. I'm deeply ashamed of it. It seems to me to be a really perverted way of expressing my wish to experience a relationship with the natural world. But yes, it did teach me a lot. I mean, there is an intimacy which exists between a man and something that he's about to kill that doesn't exist between that same man and the same thing looked at through a pair of binoculars. Perhaps it's because, and I speculate about this in the book, perhaps it's because death is the one thing which I know I'm going to share with that animal,
yeah,
beyond, without any doubt at all. And that shared experience generates a connection which isn't generated by a simple bird watcher.
Gave you back your senses, you say, hunting.
It made the senses which I took out into the wild for the purpose of this project very piquant, yes.
Charles Foster is with us. His book is Being a Beast, Adventures Across the Species Divide. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Charles Foster is joining us. We're talking about his book, Being a Beast, Adventures Across the Species Divide. Let's talk about badgers. What do you like about badgers? What made you think, I want to try that one?
I had, as I guess lots of people have, cozy childhood pictures of badgers. Badgers were the avuncular creatures in an armchair. They had corduroy trousers. They had braces. They smoked briar pipes, and they smelt of herb tobacco. They had a nice, unthreatening, shuffling gait, they would pat you on the head and give you presents for Christmas. So that's why I liked them. As I got to know more about them, I liked the fact that they are clubbable, communal, familial animals. I mean, they are cozy animals in some respects. I'm regard myself as a sort of cozy, clubbable, communitarian creature defined entirely by my relationships, and it's rather like that with badgers. So I felt that we understood each other, and I also liked the places where they go. I like deep woodland. I like the thought of sleeping in the day and crawling out at night when it's just beginning to get dark. Yeah.
There's a memorable section in the book where you describe what it's like to eat an earthworm. And I'm guessing a lot of people pay a lot of attention to that.
I regret very much writing that section, but because it is the section that people are most interested in, first of all.
But that's not what the book's about. I mean,
well, it's really not. And yeah. The reason I regret it most is because... reading it now, it seems to me to be incredibly pretentious. There's, I use wine tasting language in order to describe the terroir of worms which have come from various types of land. And all that passage does is to demonstrate the adjectives which I've accumulated over the course of a lifetime to describe how worms taste, which doesn't tell you anything whatever about the life of badgers. So it seems to me to be not answering the examination question.
The thing I wondered
to have a passage like that.
Well, the thing I wondered if you worried about was that it made the book seem like one of those sort of novelty books that you see about people trying these kinds of projects, when in fact there are more sort of profound themes that you're getting at in this book than any of that.
You're right. It is inappropriately sensationalist, and the book would have been better without it.
Like consciousness. You write about consciousness, and I loved this section where you say you figure badgers must have some kind of consciousness because you've seen them sleeping.
I've seen them sleeping, and I've seen them dreaming. And I think if you smile or grimace as badgers do when they're sleeping, and that's something which happens in your subconscious, then something must be happening in the conscious, which is a level above it. But I'm also encouraged in that belief by the fact that the more better we get looking for consciousness in the natural world, the more we see of it. So we can demonstrate it for sure in lots of non-human species, in whales and dolphins and higher primates, and in a number of species of crow. The better able we are to see it, the more there seems to be of it. So the world seems to be a garden which is very fertile for the growing up of consciousness. It seems to be springing up wherever we look, which I find very exciting, because no one has ever been able to explain why we need consciousness for anything apart from one thing, to which I'll return. So you don't need it for theory of mind, for example. You don't need it in order to perceive the contents of some other creature's mind. You can see why that gives you a selective advantage. But consciousness itself, no. The only thing that you need consciousness for is for relationship. So you can have an I-thou relationship. So the universe seems to be a garden which has been fertilized for the growing up of the capacity for relationship. So badgers seem to have, I would have thought, from my highly unscientific and anecdotal conclusions from watching them sleeping, the capacity for relationships, certainly with other badgers, and if with other badgers, why not with us, of the same sort, if not to the same degree, that we have with other human beings. That's a very, very exciting thought.
I love this lesson that you learned early on in the experience with trying to live like a badger. You say it confirmed that you were dismally suburban, that you had sort of, that you liked your own place, you preferred your own ideas, all, as you say, symptoms of colonialism, and you kind of figured you weren't like that.
Yeah, it exposed my fakery very quickly to go and live as nearly as I could like a badger. Yeah, I had thought of myself as, you know, a hairy wild man, and I really wasn't.
But you say you learned that lasting change is possible from that experience.
Yes. Habit is tremendously potent. Good habits as well as bad habits. And as anyone who's flown internationally will know, you can change your internal clock in a few days, and you can change your spiritual clock in a number of important ways as well, really quite quickly. So I was encouraged by what this elaborate experiment of whatever you want to call it, biological method acting, is that a good expression?
That is good, actually.
I was encouraged by what this showed me about the plasticity of my own brain.
You buried your watch at one point toward the end of the experience in a kind of a ceremony.
Yeah.
What was that about?
I was conscious of lots of tyrannies, and I wanted to be free of them. And one of those tyrannies was the tyranny of the ticking watch, mm-hmm. Of the presumption that time is carved up in the way that the clock says it is, rather than in the way that I feel that it is, or rather in the way that the sun says that it is. And I wanted to be able to listen to the other chronological indicators that there were in the wood. The greatest tyranny was the tyranny of my vision and therefore my cognition. So we grew up as a species on the plains of East Africa, and a glorious and catastrophic thing happened, which was that we hoisted ourselves onto our hind legs. We lifted the main repositories of our senses, our eyes and our ears and our noses, immediately away from the creatures that share that ground perspective, which are the creatures from whom we had sprung. And we immediately felt very alone. So there was a really catastrophic divorce, which we're yet to come to terms with. But it gave us, of course, something wonderful too. It gave us perspective. It gave us big vistas. It enabled us to see connections between things which, with our noses on the veldt, we hadn't been able to see. In some ways, we understood the movements of the wildebeest better than the wildebeest themselves did. But that forged a connection between vision and cognition, which mean, as we were discussing before, that most of the time when I purport to describe the natural world, what I'm describing is Charles Foster's thoughts about the natural world. So it becomes, does nature writing almost always a narcissistic enterprise, which isn't good for us.
Yeah. Well, it comes from that 6 foot above the ground perspective. You're trying to crouch down some in the way you're writing.
Right.
Yeah.
So we can regain so much by simply going back down 6 feet and 30 million years. to the time when badgers and humans had a common ancestor. It's quite an exhilarating thought, that 3 million years of time travel in the second that it takes you to drop to the ground.
Yeah, the last part of that badger experience, you sort of say that you what you figure you'd accomplished in trying to live like a badger was kind of something rather modest. That, you know, you'd lived in the same place as some badgers. But then you write about this train ride back home where you had the sense that maybe something more had happened, that there was something maybe more profound that you had learned from that experience.
Yeah. We went to the little, gentle, local town of Abergavenny in mid-Wales. It's a quiet, medieval place. The people there speak in a very gently lilting accent. Yet when they spoke to me very gently, I thought that they were thundering. The cars, which drove very sedately past, seemed to me as deafening as if I were inside a jet engine. The little low buildings seemed to tower threateningly over me. And so I got on the train and put on my iPod and put on recordings of birdsong, because it seemed to me that the experience in the wood had demonstrated to me that my real environment was not Abergavenny, let alone Oxford, but was the wood, and that I could thrive better as a human being if I were to go back literally to my roots and to reestablish the relationships which were formative to me as a member of the species as Homo sapiens growing up, because we were shaped by our contact with wolves and other non-human species just as much as we were shaped by our conversations with one another. And I felt that to go back to Oxford was to turn my back on relationships which I needed to understand in order to know who I was. I mean, Freud told us how disastrous it is when we don't acknowledge our formative relationships properly. And I felt that by turning my back literally on that wood, I was doing something akin to that. So I was worried and tried to reestablish that connection in a rather pathetic way by putting on the bird song.
Charles Foster. His book is Being a Beast, Adventures Across the Species Divide. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Charles Foster. We're talking about his book, Being a Beast, Adventures Across the Species Divide. There's this really kind of odd inconsistency in the chapter about otters when you compare it to badgers, for example. You write that badger, you don't like otters very much, and you say that they inhabit the instant. They don't pay attention to the moment. They don't connect the dots to form a personality. You said they're circuit boards and not much else. I'm not sure if that should be disappointing to people. It's incredibly honest. But would you talk about the sort of what seems like the inconsistent comparison between a badger and an otter?
Well, I was horrified to find myself writing such things. I have loved otters since I was a child. I grew up reading Henry Williamson and Gavin Maxwell, and I assumed that this was going to be the most affectionate of all the chapters.
Right.
Until I started finding out a little bit about otter biology. Otters are manic creatures. They have a basal metabolic rate, which is 40% above that of a dog. When they're swimming in cold water, it rises to about 4.5 times that of a dog. They're only awake for 6 hours each day. They've got to consume a huge number of calories. They're poised all the time on this thermodynamic knife edge over which they're about to topple at every minute. So weight for weight, if I were to eat what an otter needs to eat in the time that it's awake, I would be eating 4 Big Macs every minute. And you probably think that someone who is eating 4 Big Macs a minute isn't the sort of person you want at your most reflective dinner party.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of room left in the head of that sort of person for conversation. Now, it's entirely our fault, or partly our fault,
yeah.
Because we have stripped out the fish which the otters love to hunt from the rivers. So otters in the West Country of England like to have a diet of about 80% eels. We have killed or stopped the upward migration of about 95% of the eels. So they have to travel further, faster, and they have to be a great deal more aggressive than they used to be in the balmy days when Henry Williamson was writing Tarka the Otter. Mm. So if you want to imagine what it's like being an otter, first of all, you should have a broken relationship. You should stub your toe. You should stay up every night for a week drinking a double espresso every 10 minutes or so. At the end, you should have a bath in icy water. You should have a meal of still twitching sushi, and then you should run across a main road and be flattened by a juggernaut or have your testicles ripped off by your cousin. I mean, that's what it's like being an otter. As I say, partly the blame for that horrible picture that I've just painted is ours, because we have wrecked their lives. But still, it made empathy with these really manic animals a lot harder than I thought it was going to be.
But they are champion defecators.
Yeah, they mark out their now huge territories by sprinting. So they defecate on little mounds by the side of the river to say, "This is my patch," and sometimes to indicate to other younger members of the family that this is a good place to fish.
The evolutionary biologist Hans Kruk once did kind of this accounting that you write about in the book of otter sprainting, and he figured that they did this something like 18 times a day, which didn't include the other times they're defecating. I mean, that's a lot of pooping.
It's Olympian pooping. Absolutely.
And we should say, not to make it too sort of gimmicky, but you did, let's point out, you did this exercise with your kids in sprainting.
Well, I was interested to see how instinctively my children, when asked to mark out their territories, would emulate otters. And the answer is depressingly similarly.
Right. You say in the book that this kind of, I think you mentioned this earlier, this kind of unsympathetic conclusion you've come to about otters is sort of a betrayal of your childhood.
Right. I think a lot of, there have been a lot of casualties of treasured childhood sentiments in the course of writing this book. And I wave goodbye with a real tear to many of those. Mm-hmm. But I do think that the real world that we live in is more exciting and more variegated and more satisfying than what we get in Beatrix Potter.
Mm. I loved the section on urban foxes in London. And I get a sense that, have you ever encountered coyotes in the American West?
I never have. I would love to.
Yeah, I get the sense that they're very similar. Brilliant physiological generalists is how you describe urban foxes. I think they're the same, coyotes.
Right. Yes, I admire them very much. I mean, they have wonderful eyes, they have wonderful noses, they have wonderful ears, they have ridiculously sensitive feet with these fantastically innovated hairs. Nobody knows why a fox has to be so beautifully wired up. They seem to be prima ballerinas in an environment where they could get away with being stomping, clumping, incoordinates. So I admire them because they inhabit even human environments like the East End of London far more intensely and far more satisfactorily than I do. I lived in the East End of London for a long time, and it was a very unhappy time. And it was an unhappy time, I think, because it was so difficult there to feel local, to feel any connection with the place.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that just about everyone in London feels. You ask someone in London where they come from, and they'll never say, oh, I'm from London. They'll say, oh, I'm from Manchester, or I'm from New York, or I'm from Brighton. Nobody feels any sense of ownership. And it was the foxes that tied me to that little patch of the East End of London in a way which nothing and nobody else could have done. And because they gave me localness, they made it bearable. They allowed me to be embodied in it because I tried to embody myself in the same way that they were so excitingly embodied. And I was able to experience it vicariously through them.
There's a beautiful story you tell about seeing a vixen in a backyard having this, it just seems like a moment of connection. And I mean, not only were you sort of were looking at each other, and you say it felt as though, whether you can explain it or not, the fox was seeing you.
It was seeing me, and the way in which it was seeing me was not just physics. Yeah. It wasn't just the reflection and the refraction of light. It was the meeting of personality and personality, which was a very repercussive moment for me. I guess it's a moment that every dog owner has whenever he comes home. it changed me. It softened me. It stripped away really quite fast lots of the sort of scientific reductionist encrustation which had stopped me relating more personally to the natural world.
I don't want to have to so quickly shift through some of the animals in the book. We obviously aren't going to have time to talk about all of them, but I do want to ask you about this story that you referred to earlier about swifts. And there's this experience in Africa where you hadn't seen any swifts. And then you have this, and I don't even know how you explain it. You had this sense that, and a kind of a certain sense that they were going to arrive, and they did. And I don't get it.
I don't get it either. And I'm very excited by the fact that I don't get it.
Yeah.
But the certainty that I had when I sat bolt upright, knowing that they were going to come, was a sort of mathematical certainty, a Euclidean sort of certainty. It wasn't that I had heard them screaming in my sleep, in some corner of my subconscious mind, because swifts, when they're wintering in Africa, don't make any noise. What it meant was that I and the swifts were connected in some weird way, which reassured me that everything that I had been doing with the other species wasn't necessarily doomed to failure. And even if my laughable clumping round on all fours after badgers, fail to enter the badger's well. Even if I couldn't recondition my nose to tell me how the scent ricocheted between trees and the Welsh wood, even if I couldn't feel the magnetic sense in my bowels, which foxes feel when they align themselves in a northeasterly direction to jump on their vole. Even if I couldn't get near using those more conventional techniques, it meant that there were probably other ways in which I could intuit my way into these creatures' lives. And we've talked already about some of the mystical experiences which people have every day. And it seems to me that all of those experiences indicate that we are tied together. Whether you describe those ties in terms of Rupert Sheldrake's morphic resonance or use some of the other pictures which have been used by panpsychism, or whether you want to talk about Gaia or whatever it is, that those connections seem to be real, and we are much better humans if we acknowledge that we have those ties. And ethically, of course, it matters. You know, if you are tied to these creatures, you don't behave towards them with the lack of empathy with which humans typically act towards non-human animals. You know, all our environmental policies are examples of a lack of empathy, which if we showed them towards human beings, would be regarded as frankly psychopathic. And it's with a similar sort of thoughtlessness and lack of empathy that we do lots of the other things, whether it's biting thoughtlessly into a burger or not holding off when we're about to accelerate onto a squirrel or whatever it is.
Charles Foster. This book is Being a Beast. He joined us from the BBC studios in Oxford. Charles Foster, thank you very much for the time.
I've very much enjoyed our conversation. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.